You're listening to Recovery Radio, and I'm Denise Miller, and Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Latol Community Recovery Center, located at 531 South Main Street, Suite B in Moscow. Their phone number is 208-883-1045, and their hours of operation are Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., and oops, they're not open on Sundays and Saturdays, only just for AA meetings from 12 to 1. And their web address is latolrecoverycenter.org, and their email is latolrecoverycenter@gmail.com. And you can also find them on Facebook and Twitter. Recovery Radio's mission is to share with our community how recovery from addiction and mental health issues affect us all, and to make our community aware of the recovery resources available in our area, and to share the personal stories of the people in recovery, highlighting their experiences, strengths, and hopes for continuing recovery. I'm Denise Miller, and I am a grateful believer and happy to be here today. And I have a wonderful co-host.
Oh, well, thank
Please
you very
introduce
much.
Introduce yourself.
I will. I'm Johnny, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic, recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And grateful to be here, and grateful to, you know, be in recovery and volunteering and having good things to do for a change, which is fantastic.
Not the old chaos of the past, right?
No, no, chaos. Chaos was fun, but not necessarily all that wonderful.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'll jump into the calendar and upcoming events. We're gonna skip the long list calendar. You can find that on the website at latolrecoverycenter.org.
And today, Johnny, can you introduce our special guest today?
I will. We have a guest in the studio today, a good friend of the program and a former neighbor of mine. This is Phil, and he's fresh from major surgery. He's all slinged up and looking just slightly uncomfortable. No, I'm pretty uncomfortable. Phil, welcome. Oh, look at that. Now he's showing us his scars. Wow, that's spectacular.
I was actually just remembering now that my daughter's getting shoulder surgery in October, so we'll talk afterwards, see what kind you had versus what kind she had.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Yeah, we're so glad that you're here. Thank you.
Well, hey, Phil, may as well dive right into it. You've got an interesting story and an interesting history to share, and why don't I let you just kick it off. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right. Well, thank you very much. My name's Phil, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm an addict, Oxycontins and stuff, and then cough syrup. And that's been years and years. I met my to-be wife 30 years ago last week, and we've been married for 28. I started drinking my first drink was when I was 12, and a friend of mine got some whiskey from his dad.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and then we had to, you know, put the water in so the whiskey level would, you know, be the same, obviously.
Right.
His dad drank it on the rocks, so I don't know if you could ever tell. Anyway, so the first drink I ever had, I can remember like it was like yesterday. It was the grossest, nastiest burning sensation in my mouth and throat and stomach that I've ever had in my life, however, it was very, after that, it was heaven. Yeah. You know, I got hooked right then, and I was an alcoholic by the age of 12 or 13. Drank all the time, drank on weekends, knew high school kids. My dad was a high school teacher, and knew some of the seniors and such, so I was able to know them too. They knew, and at that time, I think the drinking age was still 19, so easy to get back then. That was my grade school / junior high / high school. Was a lot of drinking. I smoked marijuana a couple times. But I couldn't tell you what it was like by itself, because I was always drunk. You know, it took a little bit, because those were dopers. I didn't want to deal with dopers, you know. I didn't want to smoke weed, you know. So after I was drunk, obviously, with the inhibitions down a little bit, I gave in, and I felt hungry. Wanted a lot of Cheetos, I'll tell you what.
Like, got the munchies.
I had the munchies. I could tell you, that's the only thing I can really remember. Maybe the initial, when I held it in the first time into my lungs, maybe I could remember a little bit of that. But the munchies for sure. I went to college at the University of Idaho. Oh, let me back up a little bit. I start with, I consider my life in this AA in recovery, my life is in chapters. And I have my drinking fun chapter, and that's chapter one. Well, the prologue is like, I wasn't drinking until I was 12.
Right.
So then...
there was before drinking, before yes, there was 412,
and then there was...
And then
my
there's everything after that. After and then that. Groups. Yeah.
So I go, chapter one was my fun time. My time with... I would go to a basketball game. I played basketball. I was actually pretty good at it. After I was done playing, first thing we'd do is go drink. Go drink six beers or so, and then go to the dance. Same thing with football. It was drink, you know, play the game, get done, shower, go drink. Actually, we could leave back and forth and sneak in the dance, so we had, you know, beer in the cars. So it was real simple, you know. And the only time during high school that I stopped drinking alcohol was during my senior year in track, because I wanted to do the best I could. I didn't want it to cause problems, and I was able to make it through that time without drinking. Yes. And went to state that year and medaled in two events. Got my butt kicked in one. The 400 meter that blew me away. I was like, oh, my gosh. So in 1988, I came down to the University of Idaho. And the drinking got worse. Obviously, my parents weren't around. My parents were pretty easygoing. Let me back up again. At 17 years old, I got a DUI. I got pulled over for an investigation of a DUI. And... was arrested for DUI and then actually pled guilty to inattentive driving, and I blew a 1.818 on the BAC at that time, which at that time was 1.10
back right then, yeah, right.
And it was funny because I was like, I just had turned off to my parents' road, and I was like three houses away when the lights lit up and the blue and reds, and I'm like thinking to myself, do I get out and run, do I take off, go home, what are my options? So I didn't. I just hung out and went to jail. I didn't actually go to jail. I was released to my parents because I was a juvenile. Then in 1988, I went to the University of Idaho. Man, like I said, the drinking there was just insane. College. It was just crazy. Friday, Saturday was just totally drunk. Wednesday was totally drunk. I didn't smoke any weed at that time. I had a hard time with hard liquor, so I drank a lot of beer. Beer was my favorite. It was fun. Even on a Wednesday, I took classes on Tuesday night, or classes on Wednesday, so I could party Tuesday night. You know, so right. It was late. So it was like, it was Wednesday, yep. So I could party on Thursday because I had like a 1 o'clock class was my first one, so I could sleep it off.
If nothing else, alcoholics can be quite efficient, especially in planning their.
It's all
yeah.
about your routine, I suppose,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there you go.
Schedule it out, just like anybody else schedules out stuff, you know?
Absolutely.
Just, you know.
Absolutely. Well, you know, you're thinking ahead. Right. Like you said, scheduling. I was lucky my roommates... In the dorm room, we're all over 21, and so it was our fridge was, you know, set up with beer, and at that time in '88, University of Idaho was still pretty party school. I remember we had one incident, or not incident. We had a after football game party. They called it what did they call it? Mardi Gras. What's the street?
Oh, Bourbon Street.
Bourbon Street. It was a Bourbon Street party. And what happened was all the people that were over 21 or 21 or over, they had a post on their door that what they were serving. Mm-hmm. And, of course, only you had to be 21 to drink. And, obviously, that was only who drank, right?
Sure.
So, of course.
Anyway. Yeah. So, and that was just as an example, the hall was packed. And from one end to another end, it took you like probably 5 to 7 minutes to get down there because there were just so many people.
Wow.
Anyway, so, I mean, it was just, you know, and I woke up a couple times. I woke up once, like, not aware of how I got my clothes off.
You know? Uh-huh.
And that kind of spooked me, but it didn't.
A little blackout drinking?
Yeah, but it didn't stop me. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, I was like, well, what happened? And, you know, and a couple times I woke up with a female to my right or left, and I was like, what happened, you know? So those things were just, you know, those things didn't. It wasn't a clue at that time to stop because that's dangerous. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't think about it. I was 19 years old or 18 years old at that time. Probably 19, too. I was 18, 19 my freshman year. And I just kept drinking. And it was funny. My second year, I was supposed to live in the dorms, but I moved to an apartment it was like, this is like a fate thing. I'm not a big fate fan, but this is like kind of like a fate thing. So 30 years ago, my parents moved me into the apartment. My dad buys me a six-pack of beer before he takes off back home. Thanks, Dad. So I'm sitting in the windowsill. We have one of the apartments. We're the second apartment, so we have it right on the parking lot.
Right. Yeah.
Sitting in the windowsill there, and it's truck and trailers pulls in, and this older woman gets out, like a mom, looked like probably, and then there was this other lady that looked pretty awesome at the time. And she was like 6 foot at least, and nice long legs, and I was like, oh. But anyway, so according to her, that was my wife, the to-be wife, actually.
Oh, my.
We met 30 years ago last week.
Oh,
and we've been married for 28.
Super cool.
She's
fabulous.
Actually hung around for 28 years, 30 years of my drinking. Well, that year, it was fun because upstairs they had like the jungle juice and such.
Oh, right. Jungle juice. Yeah. Okay, so I'm not a big drinker, you know. But jungle juice stuff,
yeah.
The Everclear, is that what it is?
Yep.
Well, it's a combination of fruity juices,
wow,
and some sparkling Sprite or 7-Up or something, and then a heavy dose of some really strong clear liquor,
stuff.
Vodka,
so
or
vodka.
Everclear, or whatever you can get your hands on. Yeah.
I just like fruit, but that's
they
special
cut
fruit.
Cut up the fruit and throw it in there, and the big garbage.
Anyways, I'm sorry, everyone.
We used to call it the iron fist in the velvet glove.
It's just not much effort. It's like you drink half a glass, and you're like,
you don't even taste it.
Yeah,
that's the problem we had with the jungle juice. You don't Everclear. You if it's mixed right, you don't taste it. Next thing you know, you're on the floor.
Right.
Right. It's like flat on your face.
Go to brush something off your shoulder and it's the floor. Yeah, I've done that.
Yeah.
Blackout drunkenness is coming
what
along
idiot
there.
Put carpeting on this wall?
Yeah, exactly.
My nose hurts.
I stayed away from the jungle juice because downstairs, my wife lived upstairs while my girlfriend lived upstairs with two people from my hometown. And so they had, like I said, they had the jungle juice and such and music. And then down at my apartment, we had the beer, the keg. And the foosball table that we just went crazy on foosball. So we had two apartments. You could drink upstairs, downstairs, whatever. We were intermingling and such. It was a blast, really. You know, I fell down once and I cut my chin. I reopened a wound on my chin and started bleeding. I had a beer in my hand and I was so happy and proud that I didn't spill a drop of beer. But I cut my chin and
you're
was
like,
bleeding.
I got stitches, but I cut my beer. Nothing.
I saved my beer. Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's just a weird. I mean, that's the weird stuff that you you don't even realize till later on when you're in recovery or mm-hmm. actually get a clear head on your shoulders that those things were just
right. Like that, you were proud of the parts that you didn't spill your beer. You may have gotten 9 stitches and $3,000 hospital visit, but I didn't spill my beer.
I didn't spill my beer.
Actually. That patched me up, so I didn't go to the hospital that time.
Okay.
The first time I had stitches in it, but she did some butterflies and such. And so that was the first time she ever patched me up. And, 28 years later, after 14 surgeries and a whole bunch of different problems that I've had, she's still around. As long as
I think it becomes a challenge at a certain point. You know, I honestly believe that quite often women think they can change a guy when, they meet him and get married and turns out they just end up changing our diapers in the long run. So.
Yeah, I've been with my husband
for
20 years.
But God bless them for trying.
And I've given up on the changing you think. I'm just working on myself.
Yeah.
But it took me 20 years to realize that, though.
Yeah, right.
So, just saying.
Well, yeah. God bless you.
Yeah.
That takes a long time.
So I partied through school up till I was about 22. I got married in 1991. So I was 22 in 1992, 93. I was 23. Is that right? Yes.
Yeah, 88 was like 31 years ago, or 30 years ago, depending upon when you. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. My daughter's 30. She was born in 88. So
there you go.
That's why I'm like, oh,
there
88.
You go. Anyway, so my next chapter. So actually, I went to Port of Hope back then in Moscow, and I quit drinking. And I quit drinking for a number of years, probably 5 years, 4 or 5 years. Didn't go to AA. I didn't even know anything about it. Port of Hope didn't point us towards AA at that time. And then Port of Hope went away here in Moscow. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing anymore. And this was back in the early 90s.
And Port of Hope was a recovery type operation.
Yeah. So I've heard of Port of Hope in other areas, but there used to be one here in Moscow.
Yeah.
So it was like, was it like an outpatient treatment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just outpatient.
So it'd be like Weiss and Vitry, probably.
Kind of like that. People would show up. People were, you know, most of the people in there were just like, that's nudged by a judge or judge nudged or something.
Like drug court. Probation or drug court.
Right.
So I was the only one in there at that time, and I think there was 8 to 10 of us in there, and I was the only one that was there on my own accord.
Mm-hmm.
So
good.
You know, and like I said, I quit drinking. Well, then my chapter—that's chapter one. Any questions?
And you were how old
one?
When you went to Port Hope?
I'm guessing 22 or 23.
And I don't know. I mean, I know I'm paying attention to a lot of things with the controls and stuff. But was there a reason why you decided to go to Port Hope? I mean,
my wife was very concerned about my drinking.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She was 3 years. She is 3 years older than I am. Mm-hmm. So when we met, she was a fifth year senior. I was a sophomore, so
okay. So kind of like wife was like, hey, you know, I think, and so that got you in there.
Yeah,
and you went.
And the cool part for her was, I don't know, you call them a normies or whatever, but you know, she would party and she'd, you know, drink a lot and get, you know, drunk, I'm saying. Mm-hmm. But she was able to stop. She could stop.
Right. And then it's like, you know, 3 to 6 months later, she's like, I think I'll have a glass of wine. But if she wanted,
She goes down.
But she could just go for as long as she
wanted. Margarita now and again. That's what she drinks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that it's just amazing to me that that's the way she was, because I'm not that way. Mm-hmm. One drink is my start, and I know I can drink 18 beers. So if I drink one beer, I need 17 more, and I will drink them.
Yeah.
You know, drink them fast. I don't drink them. I usually drink the first maybe couple for pleasure.
Right, and then after that, you're kind of just trying to get
to
that
point.
Oh, then
it's just slamming.
You're like, I'm getting to the fun point, so then you just drink them fast.
Game on.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
So then chapter two, I consider...
No, you go ahead.
Oh, I was wondering if we were going to go that break. Chapter two is my medical, and medical goes a while. In 1995, I ruptured my back disc, and I pulled a hamstring real bad, and then I had my gallbladder out, and then shortly after I had my appendix out, and then I had these other surgeries. I've had 14 surgeries since 1995.
Were any of these, do you think, like having to do with drinking, or I mean, was it just stuff?
My gallbladder just was a bunch of sand and sludge, so I don't know if that, you know, my liver is actually, it's kind of weird because my liver is not a normal looking liver. When they did the last ultrasound on it, I have my left lobe has atrophied almost into very, very little, but my right lobe has expanded, and so my liver works normal, but it doesn't look like a liver, like a normal liver.
Wow.
And I'm guessing that's from drinking. I would say that. Well, like I said, then there was appendix, and then I had a kink in my bile duct, so I had to go over to University of Washington Medical Center and get cut, you know, and then what comes after all these surgeries, you know, it's the pills. And, you know, back then, before now that they have the script in hand, it was easy to get, you know.
Right. I want to say, I mean, I don't know if you guys remember back, but I mean, the pain pills being an issue and being addictive, we haven't known that forever. So, I mean,
I think
they used to hand them out more.
They've known it forever, liberally. But, you know, there's a lot of lawsuits coming out right now, and what was happening evidently has been that the drug companies were, even though they were aware of the potential for addiction with these things,
that we've been hearing.
They were underplaying it.
Yeah,
they were selling
them.
They were selling them based on, you know, these control pain really well, they're inexpensive, and you know, you should prescribe them like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And well, and
there's all sorts of stuff going on with that.
And honestly, there are certain people that will develop a physical addiction to it but still be able to stop. They just feel like crap and think they have the flu for a few days. On the other hand, there's people like me who would take them realize that, you know, it, because of my addictive nature, they alter my brain and the way my brain works and make me want to have more and more and more.
It's not, one's not enough.
It's the Lotto principle.
Two's not enough.
If a little is good, a lot will be better.
That's my wife says that to me all the time.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny.
You guys want to take a break and let
Sure.
Relaxes, you know, voice yeah, we and not, all that kind of
get a drink
stuff.
Of water and...
And we'll talk about chapter two.
Yeah, we'll go into
we'll
chapter two.
We'll have to speed it up a little bit because it's 133.
That's right. Well, knowing where you come from is as important.
Hi, you're listening to KRFP and Moscow Pullman's Recovery Radio, and our guest today is Phil, and he's been telling us about his life and different kinds of areas with alcohol, and was explaining some stuff on surgeries and things like that that came in your 20s, like later 20s.
Oh, yeah, started at 25. That's when they always say that, well, I've heard that life, you know, starts to go downhill when you turn 40.
And I was going to say real quick, though, just to kind of give a little bit, is you had went to Port of Hope.
Yes.
And so you were sober at this point.
I was sober from alcohol.
Sober from alcohol. Okay, cool.
Then I started sober from alcohol, and then the pills, you know, the first couple times I had surgery, I don't think the pills really mattered. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a lot of them in high school or college. Mm-hmm. So I was not real keen on, you know, taking them, but then I started to because now sure. I'm dealing with recovery.
Well, and it sounds like surgeries. You had quite a few surgeries.
Oh, too. Yeah, 14. I got two on my leg, two on my left shoulder, two on. I just actually had the one on my left shoulder on the 19th of this month. Yeah. I tore my biceps and I tore my rotator cuff again that the doctor had already patched.
You gotta quit fighting with your wife.
I'm not even saying how I hurt it. No, I actually fell down, put my hand down, and it just popped. Anyway, so I had all these surgeries throughout that time, and then I was in law enforcement, That was my career at that time. I was in law enforcement for 22 years, 4 months. I resigned in 2015 because of my back. I've had three back surgeries. The last one was a fusion. And my shoulders. I had the one shoulder surgery. I didn't feel safe to myself. And if I'm not safe to myself, I'm not safe to other people or other police officers.
Yeah, making a good call with that.
Yeah, so I just decided it was time to look for something else. Now I'm working with kids, and that's the other thing. Nice. It's just awesome. But there were things in law enforcement that I saw, had to deal with. And I started in the jail, which was really good to see people that were addicted to meth other, you know, really drunk and, you know, meth and beer or meth and heroin or something, you know, speedball and poor man's speedball. But and it was good for me because I learned how to see, observe, and treat people right, know how to talk to people by starting in the jail because it was a controlled area, you know, it was jail, you're locked in.
Yep.
You know, so you're not on the street where they're going to maybe, you know, well, I guess they could still fight you down in jail. I was in a couple scraps down there with a couple inmates. Anyway, so then I moved to the road. And in 2003, July 8th, there was a call down south that there was a guy jumping in and out of traffic and causing traffic problems. Now it was like 5:50 or something like that in the morning. So, I mean, there wasn't a lot of traffic out there. But so anyway, so I head down that way and I think that I see the guy, so I get my PA, and he's walking south on the southbound lane, and his backpack, and I see a knife in his hand, and I told the dispatcher. I got on the PA and said, hey, I need to talk to you. Well, he turns around and looks at me and flips me off, drops the backpack and flips me off. Instead of contacting him there, I wanted a little more space. I went down and turned around in a driveway, and I was between Moscow and about halfway between Moscow and Genesee, so about 5 miles out. Mm-hmm. As soon as I said I had a knife, that the guy had a knife, I had backup coming, you know, I didn't know. I was, you know, 5 miles, who knows how long it's going to take, not very long, but so I go down, turn around, come back, and then I don't turn my lights on because I had that feeling that there was just something off. So I get out and I stand in my door, there's the V we call it, and I pulled my pistol out and I put it down so the person couldn't see it. And as soon as I opened the door and did that, he yells, I'm Zoltar, you're in my way, demon. And I was not really prepared for that.
Yeah, I'm kind of drawing the blank, too.
Yeah, right. Zoltar.
Only Zoltar, and somebody said there's this member in Big when he goes, that's the machine. Yeah. That's Zoltar. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know if this guy got that from that or what. But anyway, so then he wouldn't talk. I was trying to make, you know, get him to talk because we had I had a person coming. And he pulls this thing up off his neck, and he points it at me. And I say, what is that? And he says, I could see it wasn't a weapon. I didn't know what it was, but it wasn't a weapon. Mm-hmm. He says, when this compass lines up, I'm coming to kill you. And he did that twice. And then eventually he says, knife versus gun, I'm coming to kill you. And he takes off towards me, and I yell at him three times but to drop the knife and stop. And then I open fire because I'm now, you know, defending myself.
Yeah.
So in the end, I ended up having to put in, you know, we don't shoot to kill. People say that a lot. We shoot to stop the threat. For example, we're trained to double tap, which means two shots. The last shot I shot, he stopped. So there was, in my mind, there was no need for a second shot because he dropped the knife, took steps back, and started to fall. So why, so that's just the things that I was thinking at the time. Oh, he gets back to the back of my car, and I start to move around, and he says, you're out of bullets now, MF.
Yeah.
I'm going to kill you. And I'm like, what? So I look down at my Glock, and the slide was forward. So I know that I'm out of bullets. And I took a, what's called, well, I call it a cleansing breath when I talk to college classes and stuff. Took this big breath, and then I pulled the trigger and it hit him in the chest, and then so be it. And he ended up being transferred to Lewiston and then going to over in the Seattle area, and ended up dying 18 months later from the complications from that bullet wound. Earlier in my career, so at that time I had a 5-year-old son and a 1-year-old son. And, you know, those are things that people say, does it flash in your brain at the time? No, it didn't. Those things that came.
You were dealing with what was going on right there.
So, like in 1998, after my son was born, there was a suicide of a young kid, 16-year-old high school kid, shot himself with a 30-30, or a 30-06. And I responded. I was first one on scene. And, I mean, you know, I'm not going to go into graphic detail, obviously, but it was one of the worst scenes I'd ever seen before. I immediately thought, what my kid, you know, what if this was my kid?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Then in 2007, there were other, you know, there were other suicides I went to. There were other deaths I went to. There's just all of them. I mean, I could tell you right now everything I went to. I can still recall it.
Yeah, I'm sure you can see it all. Yeah.
In 2007, we had that sniper event here in Moscow, and I was at home that night with my wife watching Grey's Anatomy. And all of a sudden, a phone rings, and I was a sergeant where I was employed. And phone rings, and I'm like, I took phone calls all weekend already, and it's Saturday, only Saturday. I've been called so many times by the troops. I say, I'm not going to answer it. So he answers it, and then she hands it to me, and she says, it's from the sheriff's office, and she sounds stressed. I'm like, all right. So I say, this is Phil. She says, Phil, we're taking automatic weapons fire at the sheriff's office. And I'm like, what? About that pause to try to wrap myself around what she just said. So next thing I know, I said, I'll be right there. I had actually taken my rifle out, M16 out that morning, and shot a bunch of rounds. So I didn't reload. I was going to clean it, so I didn't reload the mags, my bad. So I dump all the mags out. My wife is actually down helping me load my magazine so I can take my M16 out and do whatever. So I get ready. As I'm walking out the door, I had my keys to my patrol car because we had take-home cars, so my patrol car was out there. I decided to grab my personal vehicle keys, and I told my wife as I was leaving, I said, I want to take these in case I do have to do something tactical. I don't know why I was thinking that, but that's what I was thinking. And the thing that bothers me the most about that whole thing and makes me really sad still to this day is when I left, I never said I love you to my wife. And it could have been my last time she saw me. Well, then we get there. Anyway, it was a big cluster. Nobody knew what was going on. And I heard there was an officer down, and one of the guys from another department says, we need a heavy, you know, heavily armed rescue team to go in and get him. Well, I had my Explorer, so I said, I'll do it. You know, I didn't say it on the radio. I just got back in my Explorer, went down to by the post office, threw up the hatch, and I said, I'm going. Who's going with? And so a guy jumps in front. He had a pistol, so he drove. He says, I'll drive. I don't have a long gun. And then there were two old guy from one of the departments, and then my friend from that I worked with, and we went up Fifth Street and saw, this was Lee Newbill that was killed. And we didn't know anything about anything. I jump out, and I'm covering the building because we heard he was in that church.
Right.
So I'm covering that, and then they say, go, go, go. And we get going, back up, go down the hill. And at that time, I turn around, I'm in this back seat, and I'm holding on to Lee's duty belt so he doesn't fall out when we hit Jefferson and 5th. And after we hit Jefferson and 5th, then, or 5th and Jefferson, then I start to assess the damage, and I knew immediately that Lee was deceased. And it was, again, very graphic and very bad. So we get to the hospital, and then all of a sudden, there's more happens, but I got to kind of move it along. On the radio, I hear 320, 342, and I'm like, he goes, I've been shot. And I'm like, looking around. I said, and that was the first time I noticed that he wasn't with us, and he'd fallen out of the Explorer when he turned around, and then he ended up grabbing a shotgun that was there that another officer was carrying up that was with Lee, and hiding behind a tree, and then he just moved, and I'm not going to say the guy's name because I don't have any respect for the shooter. He ended up shooting him through the arm, which went through his back and then out his thigh. So we had to go back up and get him again. And I thought we were going to take rounds the second time. I really did. And we didn't. I never heard a shot. There's a funny part to the story. I have child locks on the exploder, right? It calls the exploder. And the first time I got out, I was in the V of the door because that's just the way it was. And the second time I got out, I actually had to step out of the doorway to point. My rifle. What I was doing was just tracing the windows, you know, mm-hmm. looking for muzzle flash,
right.
And didn't see anything. And then they said, "Okay, let's go." So I reached down and I grabbed the handle to get in, and it's locked. And well, I know I'm in the kill zone. I know Officer Ben's killed and Officer's been shot. So I'm out of there. I turn and run. I'm down Adams like you can't believe. I say I could have beat Carl Lewis or Usain mm-hmm. Bolt at that time. And then I took up, which actually worked out to be the best, because I took up my fort at that time was that house on 6th and Jefferson with the brick pillars in front. Mm-hmm. I hid behind those, took mm-hmm. cover behind those. Anyway, mm-hmm. So that was another issue, you know, that. So my next chapter was the cough syrup. And I started as a officer and a drug recognition expert. Mm-hmm. I knew what drugs to use and what over-the-counter stuff, not illegal, to numb the brain and stuff. And I'd never done it before, so I, you know, obviously the first time's kind of freaky. But I was having all this, I've been diagnosed with PTSD. What happens in my brain is it just starts spinning sometimes when I go past the place on the highway where Zoltar was.
Yeah.
When I go up Fifth Street, like I can't walk up Fifth Street on the south side sidewalk. It just freaks me out. It's still in my brain. So I started using, it's called dextromethorphan, or they call it Dex. It's a rave drug, too. They use it at raves and such. But it would slow down the thoughts, and it would kind of numb my brain. And once I was able to find the dosage by experimentation, I thought it was working great. You know, my wife was like, are you on something? I'm like, no. And she, you know, and I was, I'd
so
lie.
So it kind of relaxes you and calms you down.
Yeah.
You can grab a drink if you need to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of relaxes you and calms you down. And
yeah, well,
that
exactly.
Post-traumatic stress stuff, I mean, it's rough. And reminders of things, you know, going by the place where something happened or
right,
whatever
exactly.
triggers that. I mean, and yeah. living in an area where you come into contact with that all the time.
I had a friend of mine in the AA that I met, and he'd been in the military, and he was over in Afghanistan, and he had PTSD too. He had an incident where he got, I think their Humvee got hit with a RPG rocket. So we were talking about his PTSD and my PTSD, and he said, you know what, I think here's the difference. He says, when I left Afghanistan, I left my address, my everything was left there. I didn't bring it home. Mm-hmm. It's only in my head.
Right.
He says, however, with me, it's every day.
Right. You're reminded. You.
When I go to the courthouse, if I drive by the courthouse,
right,
you know.
It's.
I mean, 1912 yeah. building, that's where I first pulled over, and I saw two city officers, and I went to talk to them. That's how I found out what was going on. You know, so it's just all over the place. And I went way too far a couple times on the cough syrup. And I mean, you get into a hole, and it's weird. I mean, it is just not cool. Then I started dosing myself, and then actually went to rehab once and came out, and I was sober for a year and 6 months. And then for some reason, I said, you know, I'm going to kick this cough syrup's butt, and I'm going to drink one. And then it went back down.
Oh,
the
yeah,
yeah,
I can, yeah.
I'm going to win.
I've been there. I've been there.
And I didn't win, I'll tell you what.
It's almost like, you know, possibly like your brain is like, it's been a while, and you forget about the just traumatic part of, you know, being addicted, you know, and being in it.
Yeah.
And you just go, you know.
Yeah. I think it is tremagic.
I was going to say, I like that word. Well, I think we just made up a word.
Yeah, I also have a, you know, 8 and 10 year old. I have adult kids and the younger kids and the young ones. They come up with all sorts of cute words.
Think so tremagic, I think tremagic is awesome.
That came from.
I mean, that seems like it would fit. You know, it's trauma and it's magic, you know.
There you go.
It made me feel better. and it caused problems at work, and it caused me to, I never drank on the job or anything, or used it on the job, but I do now know after the fact that it was still,
You were thinking about it.
Well, I was thinking about it, and I was still kind of slow. I wasn't myself. And I tell people when I shot Zoltar, part of myself was taken out. I used to be like a happy-go-lucky, fun guy. Well, whether I was drinking or not.
Yeah.
And then when Lee Newbill was killed, that took a lot out of me, you know. It's hard to see that. And most people don't see that. And anyhow.
Thank God.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. Actually, there's an interesting article on the, if you look that up, there's an interesting article where it's written where they interview a guy that was actually witnessing the officer not get shot, but he was down. And then he witnessed us come in and get him, and then you have to come back because he saw the other officer get shot.
Right.
It's on, I don't know which paper it was. I want to say it's a Lewiston
Trib. Probably
Trib.
A Trib, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was, but it's an interesting, I never read it till just till a few days ago. You know,
yeah. Any of these kinds of things where you're a part of what you've gone through, you know, being part of somebody overdosing, I mean, it's just, it's life-changing.
It's hard.
Yeah.
I went to Kootenai Health, Behavioral Health up in Coeur d'Alene. And that was good. It was 21 days. Came out, and I was balls out, man. It was awesome. I was just...
Tell me about that. What's it called again?
Kootenai Behavioral Health, KBH.
Okay. And what kinds of things did they deal with there?
It's an inpatient, mm-hmm. and it's a medical inpatient. So I was looking at a couple other places, but they called and said, you know, I was on so many medications mm-hmm. that they wouldn't be able to do that, so I had to go to a medical place. So mm-hmm. KBH is
right.
one that will.
That's good to know.
They have doctors.
Yeah.
You see
yeah.
doctors every day.
Excellent.
They talk to you. It's really a good place. I really
That's
like
cool.
it. Well, then I went back downhill a year and 6 months later, and I went back to treatment, and this time I went to Boise, Interstate Hospital or something, Intermountain Hospital. Because it was a dual diagnosis mm-hmm. place, and that's what they worked on. So I was I had PTSD, and I had, at that time, what they thought was bipolar and depression. But since then, bipolar's been ruled out. So,
so the PTSD was
in the
was
depression,
creating the. The depression.
Or vice versa, chicken egg. I mean.
Well, yeah, and the bipolar diagnosis was. Probably the quite often the easy first, but yeah, it's depression can mimic that.
Oh yeah, well, and depression, and then if you're using too,
right?
You know, and then you got the ups mm-hmm. and you got the downs because you're depressed.
Sure.
I mean, that's what the psychiatrist I'm seeing
your
says.
Brain and everything.
Is that anyway? So then I actually did OD on heavy. I had a friend that had cancer, and he was in the hospital, and it. I was at the hospital, and they had to give me Narcan and all that jazz, and that was June 4th, and it was eye-opening. And
yeah.
I wasn't even around. I mean, I was, you know, out, but it was still eye-opening, if you know what I mean. I mean,
yeah.
I remember waking up a couple times and still, you know, keep breathing, and then my wife telling me, and my son had to help me down the stairs, so it's my wife and my son, you know,
mm-hmm.
he's at that time 18 or so, and it's just sad.
Yeah.
You know,
makes an impact. You may not remember all of it, but you remember parts of it, and then you hear stuff. And
when I was at KBH, they had a family day, and we had a talk with the sociologist that was there, our counselor, and he asked my son. They went around and asked questions or could speak. So, mm-hmm. asked my oldest son, "What do you think?" And he says, "Dad, I think you're a hypocrite." And I was like, ba-boom, you know. But it hit me then, you know, for a year and a half. It was working fine. And that, you know, that was in my mind.
It can sneak up on you.
Yeah.
Well, hey, we're just about up against the clock here. But I'm glad you're here today and you're sober and you're continuing on your journey. That's awesome.
Thank you very much.
And we keep an eye on you.
Yeah.
Make sure you got some accountability.
Whoa, hello. That's that A word, right?
Yeah.
It turns out it's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, absolutely. If you ever want me on the show for anything else or to continue or to go deeper into anything, Johnny knows my number, which is kind of scary, actually.
I've got your number.
And Johnny, address, so I don't know.
Johnny knows how to keep somebody accountable.
But, I'm open to anything. I will talk about my story.
Cool. Thanks.
Absolutely. Well, fabulous. Well, hey, congratulations on a successful board run.
Thanks.
Ms. Denise, I think you did great.
Thanks.
And,
you're listening to KRRP, Moscow Pullman's Recovery Radio, and we will see you again next week.
Oh, remember.
Oh,
if you think you have a problem with drugs and alcohol, you do.
Good. That's a good one.